morning. We want to welcome all of you, but especially Horning Middle School. Would those students please stand? Thank you for coming. You may be seated. And we have Wisconsin Lutheran High School. Would those students stand, please? And thank you all for coming. You may be seated. The students are here with a national prize-winning program called Court with Class. It's a program sponsored by the State Bar of Wisconsin and by the Supreme Court. Students are invited to come and hear an oral argument, and if the invitation is accepted, we send the students briefs of the case they are going to hear, and the students may engage in a variety of activities relating to that case if they wish. And as part of the program, the students meet with a justice of this court after the second case. And the discussion at that time will be as to the procedures of this court, not the substance of the case that we are about to hear. If anyone would like a summary of the case, please raise your hand and we'll give you a summary. It's easier to understand the case if you know the facts and what the legal issue is. Okay. Seeing no hands raised, we'll proceed with introducing the court to all of you. I'm Shirley Abrahamson. I am the Chief Justice. To my immediate left is Justice Patrick Crooks. He's the justice with whom you're going to meet at noon today. Seated to his left is Justice Patience Rogensack. Seated to the far left is Justice Annette Ziegler. To my immediate right is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. To her right, Justice David Presser. And on the far right, Justice Lewis Butler. With those introductions made, we will turn to our first case, 2006 AP 818, JG versus Deborah S. Wangard. Representing Deborah Wangard is Tamara H. O'Brien. You may proceed, counsel.
Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. I am Tamara O'Brien. Together with my colleague, Frank Lococo, we represent Mrs. Deborah Wangard, who is also here in person. The question in this case is whether Mrs. Wangard, Deborah, is protected by liability insurance for the allegations that she was negligent in failing to appreciate and to warn of sexual assaults committed by her husband. For all of the emotion that this case summons at its core, the case involves two very simple rules of policy construction that this case has applied time and again. First, the key provisions of the policies at issue conflict. There's a contextual ambiguity, and under rules of law that this court has consistently followed, that ambiguity has to be resolved in favor of coverage. And second, allegations of negligence, like those that are asserted against Deborah, that one should have known but didn't, simply do not allege intentional acts. They do not support an inference of an intent to harm or a lack of innocence. And they do not implicate public policies against insurance coverage for sexual assaults. Subject to your questions, I'd like to address these two issues in the context of the Tarrant and the Jessica decisions that the insurers and the lower courts relied upon. Those decisions unnecessarily forced rules of law and public policies that work when they're applied to the perpetrator of a sexual assault into circumstances where they just don't fit, with the result actually being to deprive the victim of a source of potential compensation and to deprive an innocent, though perhaps negligent insured, of the insurance coverage that was bought and paid for with their insurance premiums and that the insurance companies contracted to provide.
Ms. O'Brien, let me interrupt you if I might for a minute. My understanding of the two cases, Jessica M. F, and the other one being Terra EF. Both cases involved exclusionary provisions, identical, as I understand it, to the ones in the policies here. Both of them involved severability or separation clauses, identical to the ones involved here. And the Court of Appeals in both instances said no textual ambiguity. How do you get around that? How do you now say there is textual ambiguity?
The court in Tarrant is the court that addressed the issue of the ambiguity. And what Tarrant said was that the severability clause doesn't render the intentional act exclusion that applies to any insured ambiguous. But the court's analysis really missed the point. The court simply chose not to apply the severability provision. The ambiguity arises out of the coexistence of two policy provisions, each of which may be clear on their face, that can't be reconciled, that are inconsistent, and that cannot be applied at the same time. Policy provisions don't exist in a vacuum. And when there's the contextual ambiguity like there is between the intentional act exclusion and the severability clause, this court has said over and over and over again, you can't just ignore that ambiguity. You can't make it go away by not applying one of those conflicting clauses. And that's exactly what the court in Tarrant did. The insurers essentially concede that the policies are in conflict and that they can't both be applied at the same time. But they suggest that the ambiguity can be reconciled if you simply apply the severability clause only when it doesn't conflict with a policy exclusion. That isn't reconciling the ambiguity. That's writing it out of the policy by ignoring the language that creates the ambiguity. There are three reasons why the intentional act exclusions in the policies at issue can't be applied as they are written in these policies. First and most fundamentally is that because that's what the rules of policy construction say. We've got an intentional act exclusion that joins the purports to join the insured's interests, and we have a severability clause that promises that the interests will be treated separately. The provisions conflict, and the ambiguity has to be resolved in favor of the insured, not in favor of applying the exclusion instead of a policy clause. As in Nemitz, the intentional act exclusion must be construed to apply only where the insured seeking coverage is the intentional actor, and the severability clause must be applied to preserve coverage for an insured accused of nothing more than negligence.
You know, we have a number of cases that say when you look at and interpret insurance policies, you don't search for ambiguity. You search for the plain meaning. And when I look at the exclusionary provision here, which is identical in both policies and identical to the two cases relied on by the Court of Appeals, the emphasis is on any covered insured. And it seems to me that that covers your client. How do you get around that? You're arguing ambiguity, but we're not here to search for ambiguity. We're here to see if we can come to the plain meaning of what was intended.
Because the severability clause just as plainly promises that the insured's interests are going to be treated separately. That's the very short answer. And when you have two provisions that are both implicated by a particular claim, because they are, the allegations here involve both intentional conduct against one insured and negligent conduct against the second insured. You have to look at the allegations against the insured seeking coverage. That's what the court said in Doyle. It's a fundamental tenet of insurance law. And the allegations against Deborah in this case implicate the severability provision, which plainly says that she has a separate policy. And it can't be reconciled with an intentional act exclusion. And frankly, the intentional act exclusion, it precludes coverage for damages arising out of any act intended by the insured to cause harm. Certainly, the assaults that were committed by Stephen were a cause of the plaintiff's damages. But if the plaintiffs are going to sustain their claims against Deborah as well, they're going to have to show that her negligence was also a proximate cause of their damages. When you have concurrent causes of damage, one covered, one not covered, the burden is on the insurer to allocate the losses between the covered and uncovered claims. And if there is no logical basis to do that, then all of the coverages, all of the damages are covered.
Could I ask sort of a procedural question? You have a complaint here against Stephen, and you have a complaint against Mrs. Wangard. And you want coverage, the duty to defend for Mrs. Wangard.
Correct.
And if you prevail on that, what are the implications with respect to the damages that Mr. Wangard created, and what are the implications for the insurance company in terms of defending Mr. Wangard?
We don't challenge that there is no coverage for Mr. Wangard or any damages that are attributable to his conduct. But in order to sustain their claim, the plaintiffs have to prove that some of their damages are also allocable to Mrs. Wangard's negligence. We believe that the duty to and that the burden is on the insurers to allocate damages between covered and uncovered claims.
I mean, would you, if there were a trial, would you separate the two defendants some way? I mean, would there be two trials, or is it all one trial? Is there joint and several liability of some sort here, or I don't quite understand.
I don't think there can be joint and several liability for between a negligent and an intentional actor. The verdict, frankly, the verdict would have to have a question about whether or not Deborah Wangard was negligent, and if so, what damages are attributable to her conduct. I don't know that there have been any motions for bifurcation filed. It's always a possibility.
Well, it seems to me, in one sense, there's something appealing about your position that Mrs. Wangard should be defended for negligence. But it is just not clear to me that you aren't imposing upon the insurance company the duty to defend the results of deliberate sexual molestation by somebody else. You got to clarify this for me a little bit.
The insurance companies issued policies providing coverage whenever their insured's negligence causes harm. I don't have a better explanation other than that juries are asked all the time to determine whether damages result from negligent conduct, and if so, what is the amount of those damages? And those are the damages that the insurers would be liable to indemnify Deborah for, should they be assessed. There's no question that there is overlap here, that the damages will also be allocable to the intentional actor. There's also a claim for punitive damages, and those damages would be assessed against the intentional actor only if the conduct were sufficient to warrant. And nobody's asking the insurance companies to pay for that. We're asking them to pay the damages that are assessed for their insured's negligence because that's what they contracted to do. And going back even more, taking a step back, I mean, the appellate courts in Tarrant and in Jessica, to your point, just got it wrong It's particularly in Jessica.
This is a duty to defend case? Or duty to defend and indemnify?
It's a duty to defend and indemnify because the insurance company accepted the defense under a reservation of rights. There hasn't been any evidence offered other than the allegations of the complaint.
Okay.
The court in Jessica characterized its ruling that an intentional act exclusion precludes coverage for one who knew or should have known of someone else's intentional conduct as the next logical step from earlier decisions that had found that an intent to harm can be inferred from certain intentional conduct if the injury is so substantially certain, if injury is substantially certain to follow. But the court ignored an important threshold in that inferred intent rule. Namely, there has to be an allegation of an intentional act before the court can even consider whether injury is substantially certain to follow from that act. The court in KAG, which first set out this rule, was very clear that it's a narrow rule, and for it to apply, there are two requirements. First, there has to be intentional conduct, and second, the intentional conduct must be substantially certain to cause an injury. An allegation of negligence, that one should have known something but did not, is not an allegation of intentional conduct. You can't infer intent to harm from a non-existent intentional act. Second, the court in Jessica relied on the Hagen decision, which held there was no coverage under a mother's homeowner's policy for the son's assault, because no reasonable insured would contemplate coverage for a sexual assault committed by their son. Jessica found that no reasonable insured would contemplate coverage for a sexual assault committed by one's spouse either. That may very well be true, but there was no claim against the mother in Hagen. It wasn't the mother who was seeking coverage for her alleged negligence, and the decision doesn't support the leap that the Jessica court made from no reasonable expectation of coverage for the perpetrator of an assault to no reasonable expectation of coverage for one's negligence in failing to prevent someone else's criminal act. I mean, if an insurer doesn't have reasonable expectation of coverage for negligence, the entire purpose of liability insurance is undermined.
Counsel, if I may, the claim here is for negligence in failing to prevent the abuse of a minor by Deborah's husband, Stephen, right? If the victim were to sue Stephen, that'd be an intentional act. There might be a huge jury award because juries tend to be pretty outraged by this kind of conduct. But it might be somewhat of a hollow victory because on occasion, you know, I've seen these things happen, but the person's off in prison perhaps for the rest of their life, right? So collectability is an issue. The damages are easier to calculate in that direct act. The act caused the injury, and what's the damage? How do you distinguish between the kind of damage that a jury would award in that scenario for the intentional act from the kind of damage that a jury would award in a negligence lawsuit against the spouse of the offender? I'm trying to figure out, if the damages are, let's just say $1 million in damages, and that's for the intentional act, what's the damage for the failure to prevent that abuse? And how is that different? And would there ever be contributory negligence? Or if there's negligence, it's that one person who's responsible for the exact same dollar figure. I'm trying to figure out, as a practical matter, how a trial court deals with the special verdict and how the damage award ends up being different, or whether it's the same and it's just another way to get coverage for something that you otherwise wouldn't be able to collect.
Can be assessed against Deborah Wangard only for the damages that are approximately caused by her negligence. Well, juries are asked all the time to determine what damages resulted from this negligence.
Okay, and but to help me, put some meat on the bones for me. Where is the damage for the negligent failure to
prevent this abuse, what's the damage for that versus the damage for the actual abuse itself? Or are they the same? And maybe they're the same in this instance. I don't know.
Well, counsel, don't you have indivisible damages?
I hate to repeat myself, but it goes back to the same issue. If there are indivisible damages arising from both covered and uncovered causes, the jury does its best to allocate those damages and ask us the insurer.
The difference, counsel, in this case and in most negligence cases, where you might have different people negligently acting, causing indivisible damage. For example, we have a case before us in which somebody supplies an underage person with alcohol, which is against the law, and then the underage person drives while intoxicated and causes serious damage. And there's an allocation among all of them. But they're all negligent in that case. Here you have two types of torts, intentional and negligent. And that's not something that this court sees that often. And so I think the question is, when you have an intentional tort and a negligent tort, can you use the apportionment of damages, of causal damages, that we ordinarily use in a negligence case? If that's not their question, it's mine. And is your answer the same? You just apportion intentional and negligent?
Well, it could very well be that provides a basis for a motion for bifurcation, because obviously the damages that are awarded on the negligence claim may be unfairly impacted by the damages awarded on the intentional act claim.
But we're not there. We haven't had a trial.
We're talking about the same injuries.
Okay, we're talking about the insurance policy, and it's sort of theoretical at this stage, because we don't know whether either one will be found. Okay. I thought the difference between this case and Jessica was, in Jessica, the plaintiff's complaint alleged that the defendant knew, or in the exercise of reasonable care, should have known that her husband was engaging in sexual conduct with the victims in that case. She knew. That was the allegation. Knew or should have known.
There are factual distinctions between the cases.
Right.
Not only...
There's no complaint here that the victim, that your party, Miss Wangard, knew that he was engaging in sexual conduct with this victim.
The allegation is that she knew or should have known that her husband had a propensity to commit
a propensity assaults. To commit, but not with. Didn't know about this victim as
Correct.
Such, just a propensity. Does that make a difference with Jessica?
The court in Jessica was clearly influenced by the particular decision and facts before it. It put an emphasis, and one of the basis for distinguishing the Nemitz decision was because that case involved what the court characterized as the particular considerations of sexual abuse that arises in an intrafamily context.
Doesn't Jessica really stand for the proposition that this court says, or I'm sorry, the Court of Appeals says, where you have intentional sexual misconduct by insured A, then we're not going to have the company defend insured B under that policy, because nobody, and you've said this, nobody expects this policy to cover intentional sexual misconduct by one of the insurers. Isn't that really what Jessica stands for? You don't, may not want it to stand for that, but
that's
it could be interpreted.
That's what the court's ruling is. That's how the circuit court and the appellate court in this case interpreted the decision. We think that is intellectually unsustainable. You cannot convert. You know, negligence is defined by a failure to foresee a reasonable risk of harm when someone what someone else would have under reasonable circumstances. It doesn't become more culpable as the consequences of the negligence become more severe.
Well, you know,
I have
a problem with the intentional act exclusion. We don't cover any damages arising out of an act intended by the insured to cause personal injury. So here, intentional sexual misconduct is presumed to cause personal injury, even if you didn't intend it or think it should, it did. Then it says, it defines an intentional act. An intentional act is one whose consequences could have been foreseen by a reasonable person. So here I drive down the street at 75 miles an hour in a 25-mile zone. That's usually viewed as negligence because I don't intend by my reckless driving to cause personal injury, right? I don't. But the second part of this says an intentional act is one whose consequences could have been foreseen by a reasonable person. Well, any reasonable person should know driving 75 in a 25-mile zone is very apt to cause damages to somebody. Somebody who steps into the street, a car who's going at 25 miles an hour. So what is the correct interpretation of intended in that sentence? Is it that I intend to cause personal injury, or is it that I could foresee the consequences? It sounds to me like it's any negligent act can be excluded here as an intentional act.
The definition that the Wisconsin courts have imposed on court says that you intend the natural and probable consequences
right.
of your conduct. And it's the resulting harm that must be expected or intended in the context of an intentional act exclusion. The definition that's in the policies at issue here really begs the question because there first has to be an intentional act or omission before the court can even consider if a reasonable person would have foreseen the consequences of the intentional act. And the allegations against my client in this case are, by definition, that she did not know. She should have known, but she did not know. And there is no allegation of an intentional act.
So her failure to supervise him or to warn, it was not intended by her to cause personal injury. She was negligent. That's your position.
Yes.
And so because it doesn't fall under the first sentence, you never get to the second sentence, which is an intentional act is one whose consequences could have been foreseen, because he has a propensity, that's the allegation. The consequence would be that he's going to act again in misconduct. So you never get to the second. You're saying it's not covered by the first sentence in that.
We're saying, you know, most fundamentally, that you cannot can't join the insured's interests under a policy that has a severability clause that promises that you're going to be treated separately and in an insuring agreement that promises we are going to defend and indemnify you in the event that your negligence causes injury.
Thank you, counsel. You'll have 5 minutes in rebuttal, Ms. O'Brien. Attorney Wendy G. Gunderson, representing the Great Northern Insurance Company and the Pacific Indemnity Insurance Company.
Good morning, Justices. May it please the Court, as Justice Abrahamson just said, my name is Wendy Gunderson. I represent the respondents, Great Northern Insurance Company and Pacific Indemnity Insurance Company. Both companies issued homeowners insurance policies to the Wangards. There were two separate residences that were involved, and that's why they're two separate companies. The decision of the Court of Appeals should be affirmed for two very independent reasons. Number one, that Deborah Wangard is alleged to be an intentional actor, as that term is construed in the context of an intentional act exclusion. And second, that even if she were an innocent insured, as that term has been used in the case law, that coverage for her is barred by the policy, which says it does not cover damages arising out of an act intended by any covered person. And the courts have, even in the light of a severability provision in a policy, have construed that to mean if there are intentional acts by any covered person, there is no coverage.
Well, you know what? This is the fact situation that occurred to me. Let's suppose I have a 15-year-old. And she is in our backyard and hitting baseballs. And it is her intent to hit that baseball far enough to strike a neighbor whom the 15-year-old has had a grudge fight with. And so here's two opportunities, one to practice baseball and see how far she can hit it and how good her aim is, and two, hit, which will cause injury, hard ball at a fairly fast clip to somebody. And I see her batting the ball, and I say, one, use a wiffle ball, the softball, stop using that. And don't aim it that way. Aim it towards the empty lots, which are in the other direction, because I don't want you hitting somebody. But she continues on, and I don't take the ball away from her, and I don't watch her carefully. So I'm negligent. Now, I don't intend to hurt anybody. This is the homeowners, right?
It is.
And my kid's covered as an insured, right?
Well, it would depend on the policy language. I hate to make such a
broad
statement.
Just take this policy.
Presuming if the...
Lives at home, a dependent of mine.
It covered generally, without respect to any exclusions, I would say yes.
Okay.
Then we have to look at the exclusions.
Yeah, well, let's just take this policy, okay?
Okay.
Is my kid covered?
For striking, playing baseball, and breaking a window?
No, I want to keep it personal injury, because I don't know if you covered bodily, covered property damage. So I'm staying right within this clause. We don't cover any damages arising from an act intended by any covered person, my kid, intended by my kid to cause personal injury. And she intended it. Now, I'm mom. I'm covered by the policy, right? I'm the insured.
Right.
I bought this policy. Covers my whole family. The only difference in the case is it's, the husband instead of a kid here. All right? So, am I covered for my negligence in supervising this child?
Because we're not in the context of sexual assault of a minor.
That's why I took it outside as sexual assault. Because I wanted to see whether you're going to apply the same rules.
There's an important difference, and the rules aren't going to be applied the same way.
Okay.
The reason is that if you observe your spouse sexually molesting a minor, you know there's an actual damage that's being caused. If you observe your child...
Are you going to distinguish this on sexual misconduct versus the baseball? Is that your distinction?
The distinction comes down to coverage at this stage, at the initial stage of the case, versus a final jury determination.
That's what we're talking about. Are you going to defend me?
There would be a defense. And actually, we are defending Deborah Wangard. We're paying Mr. Lococo to defend her. There's been a lot raised in this case about whether...
What are we doing here?
Pardon me?
If you're defending her, what are we doing here?
We're defending with... subject to determination of coverage,
okay.
And that's in accordance with this court's
ultimately procedure. Are you going to defend me or not as mother?
Defended as we are in this case.
I know. Are you going to appeal? Are you going to go to court and fight about defending me?
It would depend on the allegations of the complaint. If it's alleged that you knew or should have known that your child...
Alleged I'm negligent.
Okay. See, that's where the difference comes down in this case, Judge. It depends on what facts are actually alleged in the complaint. And there's been some missing of what's actually alleged here.
Okay.
It's been claimed that it's only alleged that she didn't know but should have known. whereas the complaint is very different. The complaint alleges that over the course of 3 years, between October of 2000 and October of 2003, when the minor child was between the ages of 5 and 8, that she was molested by Stephen Wangard in the Wangard home, which was shared by Mrs. Wangard. The particular count of negligence, that paragraph 33 speaks to the count of negligence. It alleges that Stephen Wangard had intentional sexual contact, and or sexual intercourse with other minors, that she, meaning Deborah Wangard, knew or should have known that Stephen C. Wangard had a propensity to have intentional sexual contact and or sexual intercourse with minors, that despite such knowledge, she was negligent, and then it goes down and gives the manner in which she was negligent. It is alleged that she had this knowledge. It's an, the knowledge
only of propensity, not of this particular victim, unlike in the Jessica case.
Yes, not of this particular victim. There's two things that it's alleged she has knowledge of. Number one, that Stephen Wangard had intentional sexual contact and or sexual intercourse with other minors. It's alleged she had knowledge of his engaging that contact. And two, that he had a propensity to engage in that contact. So we have an allegation that Deborah Wangard, despite that knowledge, failed to warn or failed to intervene or failed to call the police. Those are the allegations of negligence against her. Now, our position in this case is, with those allegations, we're not talking about a negligence case.
Counselor, I don't think the allegations are quite as you represent them. As I read paragraph 33, it says, Deborah Wangard knew or should have known. Okay, that doesn't say she did know. It's knew or should have known that Stephen C. Wangard had intentional sexual contact and or sexual intercourse with other minors. So to me, that could easily be interpreted as another, she should have known about that too, but she could say she didn't.
Right. And where I get the despite such knowledge is the couple semicolons down.
I see that, despite such knowledge, but the knowledge is knew or should have known, so it's a qualified knowledge, I think, in regard to paragraph 33.
And in Jessica MF, the court said that even this allegation of should have known constitutes an intentional act for purposes of the intentional act exclusion for all those good policy reasons that are listed in the case. But there's another good reason why that should have known doesn't change the analysis. Because in looking at this case, the question that was presented to me a number of times, well, what if she didn't know anything? You know, what if she had no idea of what her husband was up to, either molesting other children in the past, molesting this child, of his propensity? Well, you still have to have cause. Counsel was just up here mentioned you have to prove a causal connection between the alleged negligent act or omission and the damages. So how do you prove a causal connection? If she didn't know anything, if you don't know anything, how could you do anything to intervene? So there
you don't know anything, but you should. Given the facts, it's reasonable that you would have adduced something.
And under that circumstance is, well, that's where Jessica MF's policy considerations come into effect. It's essentially saying that you should have known. Well, what leads you to should have known? That he spends a lot of time with your daughter's friends, unsupervised? What are the kind of facts that lead you to the conclusion someone should have known and it would be causal of damages? Now, Jessica MF says that there's policy reasons why we have to conclude that that kind of allegation is essentially the same thing, and we have to do it for a number of reasons. Number one,
excuse me.
It's okay. I can see a question
you're
going.
Not, thank you very much. But you're not, let me ask you in a positive way, are you asserting that there's no coverage based on causation here or a failure for a causal link?
We claim that there's no coverage here because the intentional act exclusion, as applied to the facts alleged in this complaint, including the intent to defraud the plaintiff by fraudulently transferring assets and the claims of the allegations of factual allegations and the punitive damages claims, all that is encompassed within the intentional act exclusion based on the way that the cases have interpreted and most importantly the policy reasons.
I need to have some help here because generally we don't have essentially causation as a matter of law argument in the context of the coverage question.
usually that's a fact question and not something for us to determine as a matter of law and coverage.
The reason I raised it is because we're trying to interpret what the complaint is saying by knew or should have known. Because in the context of the sexual assault of a minor, and I am limiting it to these facts intentionally because it is a unique case, what is should have known? It's not like if you have a railing on your house and someone goes and they lean against it and they fall over and fall to the ground. You should have known that the railing was loose because you didn't inspect it or you knew that that it was aging and you didn't do anything. Those are the kind of, you look at what facts could mean should have known. Now, I'm sorry. Now,
counsel, let me ask, because you've argued it a couple of times and you really haven't gotten into the argument. But you started to talk about the policy reasons and the policy reasons in Jessica and the facts of this case and the circumstances here. And I guess my question goes towards what we typically hear of these type of cases, whether or not we should be restricting our review to the four corners of the complaint and the four corners of the policy.
Right.
When you start arguing outside of the policy, that's not typically the type of argument we get from insurance companies.
Yeah. You know, and when I speak of policy, I mean what I'm talking about is that general rule of insurance policy construction that you have to construe it to meet the reasonable expectations of the insured. And the number one, and I call it policy reason of Jessica MF is no reasonable insured expects there to be coverage if they knew of or should have known, meaning closed their eyes to or ignored facts that were presented to them of the sexual assault of a minor. The second reason given in Jessica MF is that policyholders, normal policyholders of a homeowner's policy, wouldn't expect to share the risk with folks who engaged in that type of conduct. I think one of the most remarkable things about when I told people about this argument that was coming up, that they would say, what do you mean, my homeowner's policy would cover something like that? And that's really what that speaks to, is when we interpret the policy, we look to the reasonable expectations of the insured. And the third reason is actually in the concurrence of Jessica MS from Judge Schutzen, and it speaks to encouraging reporting. If you have a person who knew or should have known by what's going on for years in their own household, that you can do nothing but quash reporting by issuing a decision to say homeowner's policy will cover you if you just say you didn't know anything.
But that goes right to the question that I just asked. Typically, the argument of insurance companies is restrict our interpretation of that which is in the policy and that which is in the four corners of the complaint. And I seem to be, it appears that you're arguing that in this instance, no, we should look beyond that. We should look at public policy concerns and that we should take into account what message that we want to send in terms of this particular type of violation that's occurred and whether or not it ought to be insured, whether or not we can send a message that this should not be covered for policy reasons. And it seems to me we often hear that argument from plaintiffs, and the insurance company says, don't go there. Just look at the policy and look at the complaint. And I guess my question is, if we accept your argument, are we opening the door to move away from the four corners rule?
I don't believe so. I think we are still looking at the four corners of the complaint, but we can't get away from the fact that this is a case involving the sexual abuse of a minor. And what this court comes down to say as to the scope of your homeowner's insurance policy has ramifications. But I think this is all in keeping with the general principle of policy construction, and that is we look to the reasonable expectations of the insured. So it's insured. So it is in two parts, really. And I think it's something that we simply can't get away from.
Ms. Gunnarsson, let me ask you about the Headkey case.
Yes.
That's a case where this court, 25, 26 years ago, adopted a doctrine that we said was the modern rule of permitting recovery by innocent insureds. How does that fit in here? Isn't that something that we should be weighing as we arrive at a decision?
Headkey was a case that represented the change in the law from the focus on the property to the focus on the way the policy language was written. Prior to that time, the case law was essentially, I'm a partner with another person and we own a piece of property. If my partner burns down the building, then the law used to say, well, your partners, you're essentially the same actors. Headkey changed the focus to the way the policy language reads. And it's something that I would like to get back to in this case because the policy language is really what controls the decision in this case. We see a distinction between different cases. It's been argued there's a conflict between cases. There is no conflict if you look at the actual policy language. Some cases deal with the insured, the protected person, and other ones deal with any protected person or any covered person. We have the policy language such as that in Jessica MF and Taryn EF that speaks to any. And that goes to the second part of my argument, and that's severability. Even if you found someone to be an innocent insured, the policy is applied separately.
Counsel, I want to talk about that second argument.
Okay, I'd love to.
I understood the second argument, or the argument in part, to be that really severability clause has no bearing on the exclusionary clause here. Is that correct?
It is a separate inquiry, and the reason why is argument number one presumes she's not an innocent insured. That's our position, is she's not innocent because she's an intentional actor. Argument number two says, let's assume that you find that she is an innocent insured. You think that, you know, this is a negligence question, or that she's, you know, entirely innocent and you're not going to attribute anything to her by either the allegations of the complaint or the operation of law. Then we go to the intentional act exclusion, and does it just exclude coverage for Stephen Wangert, or does it also exclude coverage for any innocent insured? The severability policy provision in this case provides that it should be applied, the policy should be applied separately to each insured. It does not, as the severability clause in the Doyle case did, say you have to ignore the other insureds or assume that they don't even exist. That's been argued in this case, is we're supposed to interpret this policy as if Stephen Wangert were never on it. That is a distinct operation of the severability clause that was in the Doyle case. It actually said you're supposed to interpret it as if no other insured exists. Ours doesn't say that. It says apply it separately to each insured. So you go to the policy and you say, let's read that intentional act exclusion. And it says that damages do not apply for damages arising, or the coverage doesn't apply for damages arising out of, and I know everyone's looking at the clause, so I better read it word for word here. We do not cover any damages arising out of an act intended by any covered person to cause personal injury or property damage. And then it continues on. This is the policy language that was interpreted in Taryn EF, and this is distinguishable from policy language that was interpreted in Doyle and in Goldmeyer. When the policy is applied to each individual insured here, you read it to say it does not apply to the intentional act of any covered person. Well, who's a covered person under the policy? Well, both Deborah and Stephen Wangert are covered persons under the policy. That's the way Taryn EF read the similar or practically identical intentional act exclusion in light of a severability clause. Now, it was different in Doyle, and I actually had the opportunity to listen to the oral argument from Doyle, and Attorney Terry Johnson, I don't know how many times, said it's important because this language says the protected person, and if the insurance company wanted to write it differently, they could have. Well, here they did. They wrote any covered person. And so even if you find that Deborah Wangert is an innocent insured, or that you can't find, based on the allegations in the complaint, that she was an intentional actor, there is still no coverage under these policies because it precludes coverage for damages intentionally caused by any covered person.
Well, if I can ask, I understand your argument, and I think your argument makes a lot of sense in looking at the Jessica case and the severability clause, but when I look at the severability clause in Taryn, it seems to be a different type of severability clause. Now, I wanted you to address that if you could. The difference in Taryn is that each person listed above is a separate insured under this policy, whereas the severability language in Jessica is each policy also specifies that coverage applies separately to each insured. And the reason I ask the question is that it appears that at least in part, and maybe I'm overreading it, that the Jessica case was driven in part by public policy considerations, whereas the case in Taryn was more or less addressed to the policy and the complaint. And when you get specifically into the language of the policy and the complaint, maybe I'm wrong, but I see a difference between the severability clause in Tarrant than I do in the severability clause in this case.
I put the Tarrant severability clause in the same category as the one in our case, as distinguished from those in Doyle and Gohlmeier, and I think there are particularly in Doyle, because Doyle has actually a two-part severability clause, and that's how you can see the distinction between the one that says you will just apply it separately as to the, each insured, and the one that says you apply it separately as if no other insured existed.
But let me ask the question a little bit differently, because maybe I'm not making it clear. The severability clause in Tarrant says each person listed above is a separate insured under this policy.
Right.
So it seems to make sense, your argument from this case, that we are looking at one policy and you just have separate insureds under the policy.
Right.
When you look at the severability clause in this case, coverage applies separately to each covered person. And I'm not sure of the import and the difference in the language, but it seems to be saying something different.
I can just say I construe them to be the same or have the same import. And I think the reason why that I see them to be that way, other than they say coverage applies separately to each person, is there's kind of a distinction that's apparent when you look at the severability clause in Doyle. And in Doyle, it had two parts. It says we apply this agreement, one, to each protected person named in the introduction as if that protected person was the only one named there, and two, separately to each other protected person. So with that policy, it made a distinction, and that's a lot of the reason why Doyle was driven the way it was, is the distinction between not only the intentional act exclusion language and the difference in the severability clause.
Could I ask counsel, the intentional acts exclusion, is there anything about that language that is associated with Wisconsin insurance law, or is that national language?
I don't believe that it's intended to be drafted for purposes of Wisconsin law only. The carriers do business in other states as well. I know that Justice Abrahamson made a note with respect to that second provision of the intentional acts exclusion. I agree with counsel. I think the intentional act exclusion is to be interpreted under Wisconsin law, which says to be excluded under the intentional act exclusion, there has to be an intentional act and an intended injury.
How do other states, if this is uniform language, interpret that first sentence of the intentional acts?
You know, quite frankly, I didn't go to other jurisdictions because our case law here, at least established to this point in the state of Wisconsin, made this a relatively clear question. We have not only an allegation of knew or should have in the context of a sexual assault of a minor, we had the any covered person language, and we had a severability clause that wasn't of the type that we see in Doyle. So I did not go beyond, other than my general understanding is that courts in the United States generally apply intentional and act exclusion where the act's intended and the injury is intended.
Yes, but that's not, we're really focusing on a little different language, it seems to me. We're focusing on by any covered person. I want to focus a little bit on arising out of.
I love that language. And that's because
sometimes I love it too. I'm just not sure I love it today.
Well, here I think it's great because we know that this court has interpreted that provision before, and it is interpreted very broadly. And when you have a combination here of arising out of and any covered person, you've got a combination that broadens this exclusion and that encompasses the acts of Mr. Wanger.
On its face, it jumps. Now, I'm just talking about on its face. We do not cover any damage arising out of an intended act. I'm going to stop right there.
Right.
Now, what if the damage is arising out of both negligence and an intended act?
In that case, then, with respect to a defense, we defend like we've been defending. And then there would be a jury determination, as there'd be a jury question as to was this person negligent, there'd be a jury question as to was this an intentional act.
Now,
but then we get the problem of the damages.
Yeah,
Causation.
Well, we also have a little causation issue here.
If you are going to show causation, you'd have to apportion it.
If allocated. Between negligent insureds, you don't apportion between a negligent and intentional.
You do not.
You do not.
Mm-hmm. So what do you do when you have an indivisible damage?
You get stuck. You get a person who is a company that would be paying for negligent conduct, essentially paying for the acts and consequences of an intentional actor. And that's why this policy is written like this. It's written to say arising out of, and it's written to say any covered person, because a homeowner's policy is not in the business, or this company is not in the business of issuing homeowner's policies that are to cover this kind of conduct, regardless of who's alleged, whatever theory of law.
How about I'm a mother, and I'm a mother of these teenagers, right?
Which one?
My palms are sweating already. And let's say that one of them says, Mom, I'm going to go over to Billy's tonight and stay over. Okay. So on that night, I call, and no one answers at Billy's, and I call a little later, and no one answers at Billy's, and later no one came. And that this sort of thing happens when he goes to Billy's, and it's happened a few months. And then, lo and behold, something awful happens one night. And I say to myself, now this isn't a great example, but I say to myself, oh my God, I should have known that he didn't go to Billy's on those Friday nights. Where was I? Why didn't I wake up? This wouldn't have happened if I had just been, you know, been doing something. You know, I mean, part of it is denial, I suppose. I wanted to think, well, my kid's a good kid and he wouldn't lie to me, and if you said he's going to go to Billy's, you'd go to Billy's, wouldn't you? but no, and then I, you know, and I say, oh my God, you know, it was right in front of me and I didn't see it. But that's not that kind of, oh my goodness, it's right in front of me and I didn't see it. Sometimes we call that negligence, but here we don't, huh?
In the context of the sexual assault of a minor.
You know, I remember the mid-70s, we went to notice pleading. And seminars saying, hey, notice pleading. Wisconsin now is notice pleading. And those seminars said, you know, for purposes of pleading, you could say, Jim was negligent. No. On May 17th, blah, blah, in the county of, you know, Jim was negligent, and Joan was damaged, and Jim's negligence caused Joan's damages. And that was notice pleading. And then if you want more, then you can ask for a more definite and certain statement and that sort of stuff. But that was sufficient for a cause of action, we were told then, with notice pleading. But you're saying here, where there's an allegation of negligence, it's not sufficient, huh?
Oh, I'm saying the complaint states a cause of action. We haven't taken the position otherwise.
Mm-hmm. And question, a cause of action and negligence.
It alleges knew or should have known, and it calls it negligence. My point is, aside from whether the negligence claim is viable and whether they can prove it, in the context of the intentional act exclusion, and this deals strictly with policy interpretation, that it is construed to be an intentional act, and that's for the reasons given in Jessica MF. It's that, limited to that.
So your response to my kid with the insurance, with the baseball bat, is, I knew he had it in for the neighbor. I knew he was aiming in that direction. I knew what damage a baseball could do. I knew he had a propensity to want to hurt and has hurt in the past. I mean, I'm putting it exactly the same, except not sexual assault. You going to defend me and indemnify me as the mother?
Number one, I think it makes a difference that it's in the context of sexual assault.
Well,
so
that's what I'm trying to push you on, because I'm trying to push you on that.
I understand.
Because homeowners, although a lot of homeowners don't realize this, homeowners covers a lot of personal liability that the insureds may have. And the homeowners then can be enhanced by a personal liability coverage over and above the homeowner's insurance. And ordinarily, I think that if I had a kid that had a propensity to doing intentional harm, like battery, and is rough, and I do the best I can, but I can't supervise them every minute of the day, and I'm negligent because I run upstairs from the basement where these kids are playing to take a phone call, and I'm not there, I don't want this case necessarily to hold that I, the mother, am not liable. I'm not covered, because I think that in most of those cases, I would be covered, even though the kid did an intentional battery, and even though I know of his or her propensity.
I see my time's up. I'd love to answer the question, though, if I may.
You may, of course.
I think it makes a difference in the context of sexual assault of a minor because of the homeowner's policy considerations. But also, in this respect, this policy language is written in such a way to say arising out of and deals with any covered person. Under that policy language in that situation, you wouldn't be covered.
Mom wouldn't be covered.
Would not
Why
be
not?
Covered. Because it arises out of an intentional act of any covered
the kid.
Person. Right.
By this 5-year-old, that's my second child. I seem to have a lot of problems. And so it's not covered there, but it could. Is it covered under the first part?
In your fact situation, based on what I know, I would say yes. But again, I said the considerations are different.
Right. And you're really in here on the sexual assault case. That's really your point, and that's what Jessica really did.
That's what it did.
And to write broader than that raises a few problems in other circumstances.
And I'm not advocating that it be broader than that.
Thank you, Counsel.
Thank you all.
Ms. O'Brien.
If sexual assault is such a unique circumstance, then the insurance companies should have included a sexual assault exclusion in their policy, and they should have qualified the severability clause to make it clear that it doesn't apply, and we're not going to assess your coverage separately if in circumstances where there's sexual assault exclusion or the intentional act exclusion applies. They didn't do that. And the allegations in this complaint, although they're both negligent and intentional, the allegations that trigger coverage are that Deborah knew or should have known. Those are allegations of negligence and nothing more. The fact is that the existing framework for determining insurance coverage in Wisconsin would have led to the right result in Jessica had the court not departed from its role of applying the rules of law to the facts of the case. Decisions in both Taryn and Jessica not only ignored the ambiguity and construed the ambiguity in favor of coverage instead of in favor of the insured, they also removed the question of fact about the insured's intent and knowledge from the province of the jury. And they did so.
Ms. O'Brien, if we find in your favor, are we going to have to overrule those two decisions?
I'm sorry?
If we find in your favor, are we going to have to overrule those two decisions, Jessica and Taryn?
They were wrongly decided, and this court needs to correct that error.
So you're asking us to overrule them?
Yes. The decision in Jessica in particular was focused on eliminating coverage for the spouse's negligence as that would somehow deter sexual assaults and at least encourage the reporting of sexual assaults. Of a negligent, the existence or non-existence of coverage is not going to color the conduct of a negligent actor's conduct one way or the other, because by definition, a negligent actor did not foresee the risk. Even if they should have, they didn't, and they couldn't have acted to prevent the assaults. If the court in Jessica had applied the existing rules of policy construction, they would have found that the insurers were obligated to defend the grandmother because, in fact, an insured does have a reasonable expectation of coverage for allegations of negligence, and they do have a reasonable expectation that coverage will be separately assessed as to the allegations against them. The jury question would have been submitted to the jury. The jury could have reached one of three conclusions. If they determined that the grandmother knew of the husband's conduct, There may have been a basis in that case, then, to infer intent to harm, because there was knowledge and an intentional failure to act. The insurer, if the jury determines the grandmother should have known but did not, that she, then they will have confirmed that she was nothing more than negligent, no matter how severe the consequences. And there is no public policy against insuring negligence. There can't be. That is the precise reason that we all buy liability insurance. When our negligence causes injury, that's what liability insurance is for. And in particular, when you're construing allegations of negligence against the insured, one of the things this court has always advocated is how broad the duty to defend is. We've got allegations that potentially trigger in the complaint that potentially trigger coverage. The duty to defend is triggered. It continues until that question of fact is resolved one way or the other by the jury.
Could I ask, if the insurer wanted to exclude coverage for an innocent spouse or for the intentional act of the other spouse, how would they have done the intentional exclusion provision any different from what they did?
They may not have. It doesn't. The ambiguity doesn't arise out of whether or not the intentional act exclusion is clear or not. It's the coexistence of the intentional act exclusion that purports to join the insured's interests and a severability clause that promises that the coverage is going to be separate. If they wanted to make their policies clear and they wanted the severability clause to be subject to the intentional act exclusion, they should have done that. They should have written this coverage coverage applies separately to each covered person except where the intentional act exclusion applies. I mean, how simple would that have been? They issued a policy that's ambiguous, and under the law in Wisconsin, ambiguities have to be construed in favor of coverage.
Thank you, counsel.
The red light just came on.
I want to thank Ms. O'Brien and Ms. Gunderson for arguing another case that involved the duty to defend and indemnity. And the court will take this under advisement. That concludes our hearing in 2006-18-818, J.G. versus Wangard. The court will take a few moments in recess so that the students will leave if they wish to, and an additional group of students can appear.